Over the last few months, I've discovered that my present research subject generates a fair amount of surprise, even among film scholars. Now, this reaction is understandable, as these films have garnered little attention in scholarship and criticism. Studies of film genres, and specifically the Western, strongly favor Hollywood production. Surveys of French cinema tend to focus on auteurs and movements at the expense of popular genre films. And accounts of Bardot's star image dwell, sometimes exclusively, on youthful sexuality, as exhibited in Roger Vadim's Et Dieu créa la femme, or her consecration as a Nouvelle Vague icon in Jean-Luc Godard's Le Mépris. Vadim's and Godard's films are hailed as signal events in Bardot's career, and each in its way in the history of French cinema. When not overlooked entirely, the Western pictures are cast as curiosities of an aging sex symbol's film career, slouching towards its undistinguished end. Both film genres and star images are constituted by traits immanent in a corpus of films, but also through the discursive relay of journalism, scholarship, advertisement, and other media. The structural similarity snares the star image in a circular conundrum that has long vexed genre criticism, namely, that a measure of a film's fit with either star image or genre demands criteria that a priori exclude any ill-fitting characteristics in question. And so we have riddles. When is a Western not a Western? When is Bardot not Bardot? Bringing deconstructive pressure to the discordance between Bardot's Westerns and the discourse that shapes ideas of both Bardot and the Western leads, I propose, to a more differentiated understanding of her star image, of the Western genre, and more broadly of the French film industry, of which she had become the most visible figure. But before examining the three films in question, I'll first survey some of the dissonances between Bardot and the Western genre. In 1965, critic Pauline Kael pessimistically assessed the state of cinema. Quote, "The country that had pioneered the only great modern new art had mechanized and commercialized the art and the interest out of it. American movies had become a bad joke, and art or foreign movies had come to mean Brigitte Bardot in and out of towel and sheet," end of quote. Kael situates Bardot in the well-rehearsed opposition between art cinema associated with Europe and a standardized industrial product out of Hollywood. This opposition has been subject to ample nuance and revision. Nonetheless, however compromised, it persists as an important structuring reference in the study of both American and European post-war cinema. But Bardot doesn't fit neatly into this opposition. On one hand, she lends a singularly visible face to European art cinema. Et Dieu créa la femme rallied Nouvelle Vague filmmakers and marked a breakthrough for the success of European film in the United States. Auteurs Malle and Godard both made films that studied her celebrity. She is, in the words of Antoine de Beck, a new wave muse. However, Kael's complaint cuts on a different bias when she differentiates art film from a strain of European cinema whose distinction resides not in art, but in sexual content impermissible under the American production code. An inclusive survey of Bardot's filmography reveals a preponderance of highly conventional films that, nudity aside, sit comfortably in familiar genre categories, light comedies, noir melodramas, peplum films, costume dramas, and, of course, westerns. Moreover, as Ginette Vincendeau has pointed out, the directors and screenwriters of these films include Henri-Georges Clouzot, Claude Autant-Lara, Michel Audiard, and others whom François Truffaut and his cohort fingered as standard bearers of the French tradition of quality and its stultifying conventions. The entrenched opposition between European and Hollywood cinemas, one allied with auteurs and art, the other with genres and standardized production, constricts the discursive space for considering a wide swath of French post-war cinema. For example, in the 1950s and 60s, filmgoers flocked to costume musicals starring Luis Mariano, Fernandel's Don Camillo cycle, and the comedies of Bourville and Louis de Funès. These were far and away the most popular films, French films, among spectators at the time. But despite decisive appeal, these films land in a blind field when popular genre films and le cinéma français inhabit separate discursive spheres. The same cannot be said of the hyper-exposed Bardot, but the oversight remains consequential. The narrow focus often placed on her more arty films belies the quality cinema and genre pictures through which French moviegoers most often encountered her screen image. genre in post-war European cinemas has now drawn greater attention. However, not all genres inflect evenly across national contexts, leading to another dissonance. French Westerns, Lucille Ball blurts in a classic television episode, she's talking to Charles Boyer, the humor deriving from a lack of purchase so complete, it relegates the very idea to the realm of the ridiculous. With the possible exception of early silent films, the production of Westerns in France, by French studios, or in the French language has been scant. In the post-war decades, a few vehicles attempted to wrest humor from the displacement of a French star to the American West, but these films' tepid reception did little to establish French bankability in what André Bazin called le genre américain par excellence. In 1964, Jean-Louis Roperou lamented the alignement des clichés les plus éculés dans un style d'une affligeante pauvreté and de lourdes parodies d'un genre qui n'appartient qu'un seul pays. Ironically, he made his remarks just as the German Winnetou films were revealing the viability of the international Western, soon to be confirmed by Italian co-productions. The genre has since generated a buffet of what Tim Bergfelder calls culinary epithets. Spaghetti Westerns, sauerkraut Westerns, kimchi Westerns, roast beef Westerns, those are English, among others. Baguette or camembert Westerns occasionally figure on the list, but what do these rubrics lend a film beyond a nominal national and genre attribution? French Westerns exist, but as a category with recognized discursive currency, the French Western arguably does not. A further dissonance results from the encounter of the Western genre with an outsized star image that is not only French, but also female. The representation of gender is a regulating parameter of film genre, and the Western is no exception. Female characters are staples in Westerns. John Ford famously said, all he needs is a girl and a gun to make a film. But insofar as the mythic West serves as a proving ground where masculinity is formed and tested, the place of women remains circumscribed by a predominant focus on male characters and the relationships with each other. Simply creating a strong female protagonist may constitute a revisionist gesture on its own. And when she's played by a high-profile celebrity, the star image may outstrip even the greater narrative agency and character interest she commands. It's been argued that Marlene Dietrich overwhelms the narrative of her two Westerns. Joan Crawford and Barbara Stanwyck bring their signature toughness to the genre, but the heft of their imposing star presence leads to Baroque and camp twists of Western situations and settings. If seasoned veterans who made their careers in the Hollywood studios are already deemed excessive, Bardot's incandescent star image, forged outside Hollywood and in great measure off the screen, would have even stronger potential for spilling over the Western frame. And finally, the Bardot who appears in Westerns is in some measure discrepant with her own star image. In the 1950s, the ascendant star who inspired Bardomanie and Bardolatrie provocatively conjoined the youthful gamine and an unapologetic expression of adult sexual desire. Edgar Morin observed that Bardot's hairstyle, the choucoute, incongruously evoked both a schoolgirl's mop and a voluptuous bedhead. Simone de Beauvoir deemed this pairing a challenge to the myth of the eternal feminine, noting that Bardot is the hunter and not the prey, and you can see here she's posed as a puma. This jeune fille with a predatory libido flouted societal values, and her free and natural look contrasted with the manufactured glamour of older stars. However, by the time Bardot made her first Western, the nymphette who frolicked on the beach at Cannes had become a 30-something, twice-divorced mother. Times, too, were changing, and in the context of a more permissive cinema and a new social and political climate, the scandalous insolence of the young Bardot had become comparatively tame. In sum, there's something inferentially un-French, un-Western, and even un-Bardot about the Bardot Westerns. For these films to enter critical discourse, a looser and more permissive characterization of the constitutive fields of Bardot, Western, and more broadly, French cinema itself will be warranted, a differentiation that begins with the heterogeneity among the three films themselves. And for time's sake, I'm going to focus on one of them today, but I'll first say a couple words or a few words about the other two. In Louis Malle's Viva Maria, Bardot plays an Irish revolutionary who flees to Central America, where she joins a circus and befriends a singer, also named Maria, played by Jeanne Moreau. After inventing the striptease, they wind up leading a peasant revolt against the country's military and church leaders. Now, I have 3 points to make about this film. First, Mal had already plumbed Bardot's stardom in Vie Privée, and here again draws deeply on her star image. Bardot at first dresses as a boy, but is soon stumbling home half-naked from an orgy with three exhausted men. Throughout, she remains the hunter and not the prey, pursuing men both to kill them in the name of the revolution and to satisfy her desire. We again find echoes of the gamine, the dumb blonde persona, new wave resonance amplified by Moreau, a strong comic impulse, and as in some of her earlier films, she even sings and dances. Second, the film frustrates generic affiliations. If the Western Veracruz inspired the idea of pairing Bardot and Moreau, Mal characterizes his film as un pastiche d'un film d'aventure, une sorte de Zazie tropicale à gros budget, referring to Zazie dans le métro, and also a genre mixing mi-comique, mi-sérieux. I don't find a lot of sérieux in the film, though. On screen, the connection to the Western is similarly loose. We find familiar signifiers, saloons, guns, and horses, but also phonographs, automobiles, machine guns, palaces, and jungles that establish a setting distinct from the frontier era American West in time and place. Reviewers in 1965 called Viva Maria a road film, a comedy, a musical, an action picture, and only rarely a Western. And finally, the film was a hit. When box office ranking is measured as a percentage of yearly film attendance, which was in sharp decline, Viva Maria outperformed even Et Dieu créa la femme. It enjoyed an enthusiastic reception among radical student movements, which is a story unto itself. And in the United States, it sparked a censorship suit that reached the Supreme Court. But the film's impact may not be ascribed to an integration of the Bardot star image and the Western genre. Bardot's star shines brightly. The tangential cinematic Westernness remains, for the most part, beside the point. In Les Pétroleuses, Bardot plays a bandit named Frenchie King, who, with her gang of female-to-male cross-dressed train robbers, gives up her men's clothing to settle down on a Texas ranch. The women encounter a hostile welcome from the neighbors, four brothers, and their domineering sister, played by Claudia Cardinale, who wish to drive them away to claim the ranch's oil rights. The animosity culminates in a showdown between the women, a quadruple marriage of the four brothers to Frenchie's sidekicks, and the reconstitution of the outlaw gang, now led by Bardot and Cardinale, both dressed as men. In some respects, Les Pétroleuses echoes Viva Maria. We find two female stars taking on the establishment in a zany comedy. Les Pétroleuses also met with relative box office success and marks a high point in Bardot's final years as a film actress. But unlike its predecessor, Les Pétroleuses embraces a familiar Western setting in frontier-era Texas with two significant twists. First, the treatment of gender. The director Christian Jacques had previously worked with the young Bardot in Babette s'en va en guerre. Here he revises the screen persona for an older actress. In place of the sexualized jeune fille, he creates a mature character with self-composed bearing. Both Bardot's and Cardinale's characters change in and out of men's clothing, are leaders of their group, and exhibit superior skill with firearms and horses. The town's universally weak and buffoonish male citizenry puts the women's dominant side into relief. I love these. These are the Japanese posters. The lack of a strong male lead or credible heterosexual love interest allows Bardot and Cardinale to fixate on each other, and the rivalry drives the narrative more than any interest in the opposite sex. Bardot's character still presents a seductive feminine side, as need be, to achieve her goals, but as a calculating leader, not a dumb blonde sex kitten. The masculine and feminine converge in the climactic bodice-ripping fist fight, which mixes right hooks with women's undergarments in a crescendo of brimming décolletage. This revision of the Bardot persona deftly serves two purposes. It accommodates both her later career screen presence, she was 38 at the time, and the conventional traits of a Western protagonist. And a final conceit in Les Pétroleuses begs mention. The diegetic language is curiously French, a ploy enabled by setting the action in a Texas town founded by French immigrants, Bougival Junction. In Viva Maria, Mal provided no explanation for his oddly francophone Latin America, but here we have a comic alibi that justifies Bardot's delivery of lines in her signature, somewhat affectless French. Now, the least well-received of Bardot's Western films represents the most fraught encounter between the genre and her star image. The 1968 Chalaco opens with a swell of symphonic music, a mountain landscape under a blue sky, and a scrolling script. To the plains and mountains of the American West came not only the pioneer, but the European big game hunter as well. And after listing historical figures who made the voyage, including marking those who were guided by Buffalo Bill and Jim Bridger, the text continues. There were hundreds of others. Some came only to hunt and to travel. Others stayed to ranch. One or two became outlaws. They and their descendants helped the peoples of North America to build the adventurous West. And the text is signed Louis L'Amour, Hollywood, California. The scrolling text is followed by a cut to a man in light-colored buckskins who rides through a mountainous terrain. The music picks up. A succession of 10 names announces a star-studded film to come. The title Shalico appears, and the men's chorus begins singing virilely. As the credits end, the rider crosses a ridge in silhouette above veteran Hollywood director Edward Dmytryk's name, glowing in saturated technicolor red. Now, if this opening seems familiar, it's no coincidence. The credits strongly evoke studio-era Hollywood westerns, and specifically the 1953 Shane, a picture Shalico producer Ewan Lloyd called his guiding light in making his own film. Lloyd embraced the stories, style, and personnel of the studio-era western. Through the help of Alan Ladd, Shane himself, who we see in this image, Lloyd secured the rights to the book of, from L'Amour, whose stories had already inspired numerous films and television series. For the title role, Lloyd courted Henry Fonda, and only after financial backers balked did he sign Connery. Dmytryk directed, and rounding out the Hollywood Western eminence, Woody Strode played the Apache chief's son. The retro Hollywood connection continues on the screen. The hero is the tried and true leather stocking style intermediary between Eastern civilization and the wilderness. A chase sequence pays homage to John Ford's 1939 Stagecoach, a time shot for shot. And if at the conclusion an Apache chief arrives ex machina to proclaim, "There has been enough bloodshed," any revisionist note provides scant counterweight to nearly 2 hours of Apaches torturing, raping, murdering, and in a sympathy-quashing gesture that dates to D.W. Griffith, killing dogs. The hero's struggle against male adversaries fuels the narrative more than his pursuit of love, and only at the end, with social hierarchies leveled, the ills of civilization washed away, may Bardo and Connery finally get to work, though off-screen, creating those descendants who will people the renewed American nation. Lloyd's bid failed both commercially and critically. In the preceding years, Italian co-productions had renewed interest in the Western by refashioning, distorting, and sometimes vacating the conventions of Hollywood production. The spaghetti cycle was at its zenith in 1968, and Shalico struck critics as, and these are their adjectives, old-fashioned, unoriginal, routine, heavy, and conventional. Now, ironically, Shalico is in fact an exceptionally modern and cosmopolitan film with an international cast and crew, the same Spanish shooting locations as many of its spaghetti contemporaries, and an unprecedented financing arrangement with co-producers from over 30 countries. Bemused critics observe two emblems of modern European sexuality laboring under the Spanish sun in this relentlessly earnest film. Connery's low-key performance garnered some mixed recognition of his ability to fill the role of a Western hero, but the presence of Bardo drew nothing short of bewilderment. In Vive Maria and Les Pétroleuses, Bardo's character harmonized with her star image. The opening credits of Shalico announce a contrary strategy: isolate Bardo's screen presence from her star image and to contain it in a retro-Western frame. That scrolling text we just saw preemptively casts Bardo in a matriarchal role in the narrative of American national regeneration. The song's lyrics subordinate her character's narrative and sexual agency to that of the hero. She's not the hunter, but the prize. And the title and montage of Connery's ride announce that it is his movie, while Bardo's name, embedded among those of 9 co-stars, concedes no recognition of her singular celebrity. And the whole bears the stamp Hollywood, California, a place Bardo never worked, and in contrast to which her rise to fame drew energy. The credit sequence effectively announces that Shalico will be a good old Western that just happens to star Brigitte Bardot. But nobody puts Bebe in a corner. From her first appearance, she strains against the retro Western frame. Following the credits, I regret I don't have a clip. I had trouble burning the clip, so I had to go to stills here. Following the credits, the film opens with a group of men baiting a mountain lion that Countess Irina Lazar, played by Bardot, shoots for sport. Now, the sight of the animal rights activist gleefully abusing and killing the lion is, for today's spectator, stupefying. And even in 1968, Bardot was a well-known animal lover. The styling of the film amplifies the discordance. Bardot peers out from under a scarapace of a costume, heavy coat and skirt, high-necked blouse, hair pulled under a hat, that could not be farther from the look of the fashion icon who, a few months earlier, was photographed dining barefoot at Maxime's. Eventually, the hair comes down and the coat comes off, but until the final minutes of the film, a short dressing sequence excepted, the blouse remains modestly buttoned. The prim costuming is consistent with the Countess's traditional views on love. When Connery's Shalico steals a kiss about halfway through the film, Bardot's character talks of marriage and rejects his advances. It's impossible, no. As if conforming to a production code that no longer exists. The casting of ex-Bond girl Honor Blackman, who played Pussy Galore, as the sexually forward Lady Julia, further pits Bardot against the constitutive traits of her own image. Bardot's Countess sighs, pardon my imitation of her, I can't help myself, I wish I could be more like Julia. She takes what she wants. Now, this line is uttered by an actress known precisely for taking what she wants on screen and off. At the time, she was carrying on a public extramarital affair with singer Serge Gainsbourg. Bardot's appearance in Shalico baffled critics. Le Monde critic Jean de Baroncelli flatly declared a bad fit. Elle s'est complètement trompée de scénario. The scenario, finally, is written in English, a language Bardot spoke poorly. Her chaste protests and other lines are heavily accented and at times incomprehensible. A few years earlier in Dear Brigitte, Bardot's strongly inflected English participates in her signature modern French femininity that enthralls her American guests, whom she receives barefoot and tousled in a simple dress as she coddles her beloved animals. She uses the inflected speech to gently flirt with both the 8-year-old Billy Mummy and the aging James Stewart. In Shalako, this same voice again asserts a foreign presence in a Hollywood-style film, but the labored delivery is jarring both to hear and to watch, and is at times impossible to understand. One critic observes, quote, Miss Bardot clearly has a lovely time speaking inflected American English, end of quote. Another says, quote, awkward and rapidly annoying delivery. And finally another, quote, impossible lines for Miss Bardot to speak in her still limited English, end quote. The staccato blurt of tortured English phonemes lends credence to Bardot's claim that she learned the lines comme un perroquet and had never actually read the script. During coaching, she writes, Je n'y comprenais rien. J'écoutais en pensant à autre chose. Je disais, yes, yes, en fumant une cigarette. Nicholas Page observes that Bardot's screen image is always, quote, always dialectically torn between fiction and documentary, end quote. The same could be said of her labored English speech. The spectacle of the actress struggling, stumbling, and at times failing to deliver comprehensible lines cuts through the logics of character, narrative, genre, and even of the script's language with a rival mode of address. She is not only a foreigner in the film's fiction, she asserts a presence that is foreign to the Western diegesis itself. To conclude, here we have three very different directors, three different films, and three different draws on Bardot and the Western. Only very permissive understandings of Frenchness and Westernness allow these films to be grouped together as French Westerns, a category that remains a volatile conjunction of two distinct elements. One could argue that Shalako, though not really French at all, is in this respect emblematic of the French Western. Through Bardot's screen presence, including her speech, French and Western operate as separate and sometimes competing modes of address. And when the former asserts itself, those charcoal-rimmed eyes may stare out at the spectator, defying absorption into the melting pots of either the mythic American West or of cosmopolitan transnational cinema.